the soup said. I'll be in touch. The phone went dead. Reacher passed it back to Bramall, who plugged it into charge. Mackenzie said,
Does this help us?
Reacher said, It might not be her.
Suppose it is.
It gives us a wounded Marine officer and a wounded Army officer in the same place for 6 months. Such a thing could go either way. They could have been the worst addicts in the history of the world. Or they could have been doing better with each other's moral support. Or maybe they were never users at all. They were very impressive people, after all. Porterfield quit school and rushed to sign up. Rose was top 10 at West Point and did 5 tours. Maybe they got together for peace and quiet with someone who understood.
Then where is she now?
That's the problem. That question is also an answer.
Sadly,
she said,
it forces us to conclude that these days she's more likely to be an addict than very impressive, or she'd still be calling me.
Worst case.
You were leaning away.
Still am, Reacher said, still hoping for the best. May I ask you a personal question?
I suppose, she said.
What kind of twins are you and Rose? Do you look exactly alike?
She nodded. We're identical twins, literally, more so than most.
Then we should stop by the hospital.
Why?
By now, people are hurting. I guess some of them might have friends who might be willing to share. I guess some of them will try to score in town. The rest will go to the emergency room. They'll claim a raging toothache or a crippling backache, whatever can't be tested. But pain is a thing now, so the doctor has to take their word for it. He has to write a prescription for the good stuff. We should check if she's been there. You'll remind them of her, like a human missing persons billboard.
I feel like I'm betraying her. I'm accepting she's a junkie.
It's a percentage game. We have to start somewhere.
She was quiet a long moment. Then she said, Okay, let's go.
Bramall started the big V8 motor and steered a wide circle toward the head of the driveway. They turned their backs on the flat acre with the long view east and the brown board house with the ancient millwork and the old church pew. They settled in for 3 rough miles, and then the dirt road again. But coming the other way out of the driveway right at that moment was the woman who had baked the strawberry pie. The woman who lived there, home from the market in her Jeep SUV. Bramall stopped and backed up to let her by, but she stopped, too, side by side, and buzzed her window down. Bramall buzzed his window down. So did Reacher. The woman recognized them from the day before, and she nodded cautiously, and then she peered beyond them at Mackenzie, who she didn't recognize. No sign at all, nothing there. The exact replica, the human billboard. A stranger. The woman said,
Can I help you folks?
Reacher said, We came by to check a couple of things connected to what we spoke about yesterday. We didn't know you were out.
Yes, you did. I passed you at the turn.
Perhaps we didn't notice.
You're private detectives. You're supposed to notice.
We're looking for a missing woman, Reacher said. Maybe we were preoccupied.
What things do you want to check?
About when you saw Porterfield, Reacher said. Was he disabled in any way?
I don't think so.
2 arms and 2 legs?
Sure.
Was he limping at all?
I don't think so.
Talking well and thinking straight?
He was very courteous. And polite.
Okay, Reacher said. Now about that one time on the dirt road and what you saw in Porterfield's car. Can you tell us about that again?
There was nothing in the car. I was wrong.
Suppose you were right. What did you see? She paused a beat.
It was real quick, she said. Two cars passing, that's all. The wind was up like a dust storm.
Even so, Reacher said. What did you see? She paused again.
A girl turning away, she said, and a silvery color.
It stuck in your mind.
It was weird.
Had you ever seen such a thing before?
Never.
Did you ever see such a thing again?
Never.
Are you absolutely sure? Reacher said. How about in a different car? All alone, maybe driving in from west of here.
Never,
the woman said again.
Are you making fun of me?
No, I promise. Now here's a different question. Do you let people use your driveway any old time they want to?
Apart from you?
Point taken, Reacher said. But is it generally okay for folks to drive in and use your forest trails?
No, it is not.
You never allow that.
Why would I?
You ever see it happen nonetheless? By trespassers, maybe?
Never,
she said for the fourth time.
What's going on?
The real reason we're here is we followed a truck. It was kind of escaping. It drove up your driveway and out again on one of your trails. We don't know which one.
The woman looked all around. She said, it escaped you here.
You ever had that kind of a thing happen before?
Never,
the woman said again.
How could it happen? How would anyone know where my trails go anyway?
West Point, Reacher thought, back when reading maps was a life-saving skill. He said, where do your trails go, in fact?
All over, she said. You can get to Colorado if you want. Who were you chasing? They must have been panicking to come through here.
We think the driver was a woman.
Okay.
She looked kind of small, and she was turning away. We didn't see her face. The woman said nothing. There was a silvery color.
Oh, my God.
The same as you saw before.
Here?
We followed the truck right in.
You're going to give me nightmares.
They left her there and drove back down the driveway to the dirt road and the two-lane and Laramie. The hospital was out by the university. Perhaps it was connected. The emergency room had 7 patients waiting. 2 of them could have been suffering from Billy's absence. They looked shaky and damp, a likely diagnosis. The other 5 could have been students. All 7 looked up, like people do in waiting rooms. They checked out the new arrivals, including Mackenzie. No hint of recognition. Nor was there at the desk. Mackenzie asked after a patient named Rose Sanderson, and a helpful woman checked the screen and smiled an encouraging smile and said they had seen no one with that name, while all the time looking Mackenzie straight in the eye in an open and frank and perfectly compassionate way, without a hint of recognition. Mackenzie stepped away from the desk and said,
okay. Either she's got friends willing to share, or she's in town right now, trying to score.
They drove to the corner of 3rd and Grand and checked block by block for the combination they wanted, which was 2 bad bars and a decent place to eat, all within sight of each other. They needed a meal, but Mackenzie didn't want to burn surveillance time. She wanted to watch while she ate, at least 2 plausible places. So they found a cafe across the street from 2 cowboy bars
both with neon beer signs behind unwashed windows. They figured there might be business transacted in such places. Cowboys liked pain pills, the same as anyone else. Maybe more so, because of rodeo accidents and roping injuries and other random falls off horses. The cafe was a new-age place with all kinds of healing juices and sandwiches Reacher figured had been put together by a blind man. All kinds of random ingredients, huge seeds in the bread, like sawdust mixed with ball bearings. Bramall went to wash up, leaving Mackenzie and Reacher alone at the table. She took off her jacket and turned left and right to hang it on the frame of her chair. She looked back at him. Pale, flawless skin, perfect bones, delicate features. Green eyes, full of sorrow. She said,
"I apologize."
He said, "For what?"
"When we first met, I said you were a weird obsessive, two soldiers short of a squawk."
"I think it was me who said that."
"Only because you knew I was thinking it."
"You had a good reason."
"Maybe," she said. "But now I'm glad you're here."
"I'm glad to hear it."
"I should pay you what I pay Mr. Bramall, the same daily rate."
"I don't want to be paid," Reacher said.
"You think virtue is its own reward?"
"I don't know much about virtue. I just want to find out what happened. I can't charge money for a private satisfaction."
Bramall came back, and they ate, and they watched out the window. They saw nothing. Mackenzie paid. Reacher said,
"There's another bar we could look at."
"Like these?"
Bramall said. "A little better, maybe. There might be a guy we could talk to."
He led them a block over toward the railroad tracks and two blocks down to the bar with the bullet hole in the mirror. The same guy was at the same table with the same kind of long neck bottle. The helpful guy, or the busybody into everyone's business, or the local expert full of specialist knowledge, or the mixture of all three. His table was only a two-top, so Mackenzie sat down across from him, and Bramall and Reacher stood behind her. The guy said,
"You're the gentleman who asked me about Mule Crossing."
"Correct," Reacher said.
"Did you find it, or did you blink and miss it?"
He was talking to Reacher, but he was looking at Mackenzie.
Odd not to. The mass of hair, and the face, and the eyes, and the small, slender form under the thin white blouse. No hint of recognition.
"I found it," Reacher said. "In fact, I heard a story down there. A year and a half ago, someone got eaten by a bear."
The guy took a long pull on his bottle. He wiped foam off his lip. He said,
"Seymour Porterfield."
"You knew him?"
"My buddy's friend was the guy who fixed his roof when it leaked, which was about every winter because it was built all wrong. So I heard things. I know about the land from way back. Those were railroad acres, even though the track was nowhere near. Some old scam, more than 100 years ago. Every once in a while, some rich guy back east would inherit a deed and come on out and build a cabin. In Porterfield's case, it was his father. He built a modern style, which I guess is why the roof was leaking. Then later he died and Porterfield got the title in his will. I guess he decided he liked the simple life because he moved in full time."
"What did he do for a living?"
"He was on the phone all the time, and he drove around a lot."
"Doing what?"
"No one seemed to know exactly.
Maybe a hobby.
He had all his daddy's money, some kind of old fortune back east. Maybe ironworks, hence the railroad connection."
"What kind of a guy was he?"
"He was a college boy and a former Marine, but the old money kind of both.
How was his health?
The guy paused a beat. He said, weird you should ask that.
Why?
His health looked fine from the outside. You could have put him on a movie poster. But he had economy packs of surgical dressings in his house, and also his medicine cabinet was jammed with pills.
Your buddy's friend would check a thing like that?
You know, in passing.
Was there ever any trouble there? Any strangers showing up unannounced? Any kind of weird shit going on?
The guy shook his head. No strangers, he said. No trouble either. And nothing weird until the secret girlfriend showed up.
Chapter 29.
The guy with the long neck bottle said, I guess it was the start of the winter before the last one. Porterfield's roof was leaking bad again. My buddy's friend was out there all the time. Sometimes he would get a look in through a window. He started seeing her stuff, more and more of it, but he never saw her. If he had to do inside work, sometimes she wasn't there, and if she was, she would hide in the bedroom. He was sure of it.
She wasn't always there, Reacher said.
Neither was he sometimes. She must have had a place of her own. I guess they were back and forth.
But when she was there, she didn't hide her stuff, Reacher said.
No, it was right out in the open.
Any chance of confusion? Maybe it was all Porterfield's stuff.
The guy shook his head. He said, I don't think so, especially the nightwear. And you can tell by the look of a place. Men and women make a mess two different ways. This was both ways at once, let me tell you, right there. Two of everything. Two people. Two plates in the sink, two books by the sofa, both sides of the bed with a dent. Clearly your buddy's friend undertook an extensive investigation.
A roof covers the whole house, man.
Supposed to, anyway. But your buddy's friend never actually met her.
Which is why he called her the secret girlfriend.
Never saw her coming and going or out on the road?
Never.
Did Porterfield ever say anything about her?
The guy drained his bottle and set it down on the table. He said,
I never denied it.
He never came right out and said some weird thing like, hey, by the way, I don't have a girlfriend. But equally, he never said, by the way, my girlfriend is taking a nap, so don't go in the bedroom. All he ever said was, don't go in. Period. He never said why. All in all, my buddy's friend said being there was a weird experience, like Porterfield was hiding her away and denying her existence so no one would ever come looking for her. Except that made no sense, because her stuff was everywhere. I think a man with bad intentions would have taken better precautions.
Reacher said, did you believe the story about the bear?
The sheriff did,
the guy said.
That's about all that matters. You got doubts?
I wasn't there, but everyone had the same private reaction. It was automatic. Once or twice in your life, you find yourself wondering what you would do if there truly was a guy who had to go. Or you wonder what you would do if something got way out of hand and someone ended up dead when he wasn't supposed to. Either way, you would dump him in the high woods, exactly the kind of place where Porterfield was found. It's a total no-brainer. Maybe you would smear him with honey or nick another couple of veins to keep the smell fresh. Maybe you would get lucky with the big animals, maybe you wouldn't, but either way, you don't need them. You got hundreds of other species already lining up and licking their lips. So what I'm saying is, I promise you, every guy who heard the news about Porterfield was thinking, hell yeah, that's how I would do it. I know I was.
You think the sheriff was, really?
Privately,
sure. But publicly, he called it an accident. No proof, the guy said. That's the whole beauty of it. Did Porterfield have enemies?
He was a rich guy from back east. I'm sure they all have enemies.
What happened to the woman?
Rumor was she stuck around.
No one knew exactly where. No one knew who they were looking for because no one knew what she looked like in the first place.
What happened to Porterfield's roof?
The sheriff told my buddy's friend to fix it good, once and for all. So he put new metal over the bad part, which is what he had wanted to do all along, except Porterfield would never let him, because it wasn't that way in the architect's drawing. They bought the guy another bottle of his favorite beer and left him there. They walked back to the Toyota, which was parked across the street from the New Age Cafe, on the far curb about halfway between the two bars, with their beer signs and their dirty windows. By that point, the street lights were on. The sky was dark, the cafe was closed. There was noise in the bars, but their doors were shut. There were three guys fanned out around the Toyota, out in the street, casting shadows as if ready to repel a hostile attack. They were all wiry, but also tall. They all had big, blunt hands. They were all wearing denim and boots. One of them Lizard. Bramall stopped in the shadows. Reacher and Mackenzie stopped behind him. Mackenzie said,
"Who are they?"
"Cowboys," Reacher said. "Weaned on beef jerky and fried rattlesnake."
"What do they want?"
"My guess is to scare us off. This kind of choreography usually involves that kind of thing."
"Scare us off? What? What are we doing?"
"We're poking around. We're asking questions about a woman who may be involved in some kind of unsavory local business. We're making them nervous."
"What do we do?"
"I need to consult with my senior partner about who goes first." Bramall said,
"Do you have a preference?"
"I think we should all go together. Maybe me one step ahead, but I want you to see their faces."
"Why?"
"If I lose, you can give the cops a description from my hospital bedside."
"Lose what?"
Mackenzie said.
"I'm sure all they want to do is talk to us. I'm sure they'll be aggressive and unpleasant and so on, but I don't see how it necessarily becomes a fight, unless we choose to make it one."
"Where do you live?"
"Lake Forest, Illinois."
"Okay.
What does that mean?"
"This is already a fight. You can tell by the way they're standing. It's win or go home."
"Did Scorpio send them?"
"That would be a logical assumption," Reacher said. "Technically, the unsavory local business is his, all the way up to Montana, apparently. But it's also the opposite of logical. If Scorpio can whistle up three good-looking cowboys at the drop of a hat, why would he have told a half-assed punk like Billy to shoot me from behind a tree? He would have told these guys instead. Maybe this is some kind of distant local subcommittee, some kind of spontaneous democracy that Scorpio knows nothing about."
"You worried about them?"
Bramall said.
"You mentioned losing."
"Cowboys are the worst," Reacher said. "Not much I can do to them that a horse already hasn't." He stepped out of the shadows and walked ahead through the evening gloom. His heels were loud on the concrete. Behind him, Bramall and Mackenzie caught up and closed the gap. They stepped off the sidewalk and crossed the street at an angle. They headed straight for the car. The three guys moved, flowing outward to meet them, bunching up, one guy ahead and two behind, like a mirror image. Reacher was wrestling with the brawler's eternal dilemma, which was, why not just take out the point man immediately? A surprise headbutt. Don't even stop walking. Often the smart play. But not always. Reacher stopped, and the cowboys stopped, and they ended up about 8 feet apart,
That close, Reacher thought they looked like three useful characters. Two could have been in their early 40s, and the third could have been 10 years younger. He was the point man. He had the lizard boots.
"Let me guess," Reacher said. "You're here to give us a message."
"That's fine. Everyone has the right to be heard. We'll give you 30 seconds. Start now, if you like. Speak clearly. Translate any local words or phrases." The guy with the lizard boots said,
"The message is, go back where you came from. Ain't nothing for you here."
Reacher shook his head.
"That can't be right," he said.
"Are you sure you heard the message correctly? Generally speaking, folks out here like to welcome a stranger." The guy said,
"I got the message right."
Nothing more. Reacher said, "Tell me when we get to the part where you say you'll kick our ass if we don't get going." The guy didn't answer. Reacher watched him, watched all of them. They weren't backing off, but they weren't coming on forward either. They were static. They were like a rookie squad when the plan stops working. Something had derailed them. Not Mackenzie. They were looking at her way more than they should in the middle of a tense get-out-of-town showdown. But the looking was pure animal biology, not recognition. Mostly it showed in their mouths. The guy with the boots said,
"No one's ass needs to get kicked."
"I agree," Reacher said. "Least of all mine."
"But you should, give it up."
"Here's a counteroffer," Reacher said. "You don't mess with me, I won't mess with you." The guy nodded, not like he agreed, but like he understood the sentence. Reacher said, "Look, kid," and beckoned the guy close, as if for a private word, like two world leaders sharing a confidence. Reacher put his hand on the guy's elbow, a friendly gesture, inclusive, intimate. Maybe even conspiratorial. He squeezed. He whispered, "Tell whoever sent you this won't be like the FBI or the DEA or the ATF. Tell whoever sent you this time it's the U.S. Army." The guy reacted. Reacher felt it in his elbow. Then he let him go and the 8-foot gap opened up again. Reacher stood square on and up straight. His old, professional pose. Sooner or later, everyone's thoughts turned to violence. Better to deal with that up front. Better to say, "You have got to be kidding me." So he stood, chin up, his full height, shoulders back, hands loose. Not a circus freak, but a little bigger all around than a normal big guy. Enough so they noticed. Plus the eyes, which he found most people liked, except he could blink and come back different, like changing the channel from a happy show to some bleak documentary about prehistoric survival a million years ago. Then suddenly, he changed the channel again and smiled and nodded in a shared, self-deprecating kind of a way, as if obviously two guys such as them could only be kidding around, and the other four would catch on eventually. Always offered the other guy a graceful exit. The guy in the boots took it. He smiled back like they were just two old boys horsing around, which could happen any time, and especially in the presence of such a pretty lady. Then he turned around and led his guys away. Reacher crossed to the opposite sidewalk and watched them around the corner. They climbed in a huge crew cab pickup parked head in by a fence. It backed out and took off. It turned left at the first four-way and was lost to sight.
"See," Mackenzie said, "it didn't have to be a fight."
Reacher said nothing. He stared at her. Then he stared at the corner where the pickup had turned. Something wrong with the wrong thing. He said to Bramall, "Did you take interrogation classes with us?"
Grandma said. Only this semester with the rubber hoses.
We were taught the art of interrogation is mostly about listening. His language was weird. His choice of phrase. At the end, he said, we should give it up. What did that mean? Give what up?
Our quest, Mackenzie said. Our search for Rose.
Obviously. I mean, to give something up, you have to be doing it in the first place, and that's about all we've been doing. There's nothing else we could give up.
What category of person would care either way about our search for Rose?
All kinds. We could be treading on a lot of different toes.
What category of person might care most of all? Mackenzie didn't answer.
Tell whoever sent you.
In his mind, Reacher heard General Simpson's voice on the phone from West Point. She might not want to be found. Then he thought, no, that can't be right. Chapter 30. Reacher said, at the beginning, the guy said, there's nothing for us here. Then at the end, he said the thing about giving it up. It was a politely threatening opening statement and a politely threatening closing statement. But in the middle, he declined to fight. I think for one particular reason. He was unsettled. There was a new factor he hadn't been briefed on. He was still getting used to it. He had been sent to kick ass, but all of a sudden he realized we were the kind of people who might kick back. He hadn't been warned about that. Which is weird, because every question we ever asked in this town, we asked it standing up. We weren't hiding. Who would send a guy with a message without giving him our descriptions? Mackenzie said, I don't know. Maybe someone who never saw us standing up. Maybe someone who never really saw us at all, except as vague shapes slumped down in a car as she sped past on the dirt road. Hypothetically, it would be the car she remembered, not us, a black Toyota Land Cruiser with Illinois plates. Maybe she asked three loyal friends to track it down and run off whoever was in it, because she doesn't want to be found. Mackenzie said,
do you think that's who they were?
I did for a moment. I told him the U.S. Army was coming, and he reacted. At first, I thought he was impressed. Then later, I thought, no. His reaction might be because the person who sent him was also U.S. Army. He might have been surprised about the weird connection. He might not have known what it meant. He might have wanted to get away and report back.
To Rose, Mackenzie said. Those were her friends.
Except they weren't, Reacher said. They were nothing to do with Rose. We know for sure they never even met her. We know that because they didn't recognize you. How could they be friends with your twin without knowing who you were? That's why I wanted you close enough to see their faces, so they could see yours. They would have been staring at you full of confusion, but they weren't.
So, who were they?
I don't know, Reacher said. They drove back to the hotel. Bramall went straight upstairs. Reacher stayed out in the parking lot. He looked up at the night sky. It was black and huge and dusted with stars. They were very bright, and there were millions of them. The American West. Mackenzie came out and stood beside him. She said,
we could be in the wrong place entirely.
Reacher was still looking at the sky.
In the universe? He said.
In this state. No one recognizes me, which means no one has seen her. All we know is 6 weeks ago she was in some part of Billy's very large territory when she traded her ring. Why conclude it was this part?
Porterfield's house. She wasn't there full time, the roofer said so. Yet no one ever saw her heading for the turn, which means
She came and went from the other direction.
2 years ago.
Why would she move?
Her boyfriend died. People move after a thing like that. It's a shock.
She did 5 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. She's had worse shocks. She would have assessed the situation tactically. No one had ever seen her. There was no realistic threat vector against her current billet. Presumably, it was a decent place. It had been good enough for Porterfield to come over. Why give it up? Replacing it would be tough.
I would move.
She would stay.
You know her better.
I know how a person lives through 5 tours.
I hope you're right.
We'll find out tomorrow, he said. We know roughly where she is. She can't hide forever.
I wanted to buy you a drink, she said, to thank you, since you won't let me pay you. But there's no bar in this hotel.
No need to thank me either, Reacher said.
I would have enjoyed it.
Me too, I guess. She moved away a couple of steps and sat down on a concrete bench. He sat down beside her. She said,
Are you married?
No, he said. But you are. She laughed, short but soft. She said,
It was an unconnected question. Just purely out of interest, it wasn't the Freudian slip.
Tell me about Mr. McKenzie.
He's a nice man. We're a good match.
You have children?
Not yet.
Can I ask an unconnected question of my own, just purely out of interest? She said,
I suppose.
It's kind of weird, and I don't want you to take it the wrong way.
I'll try.
How does it feel to be so good-looking?
Yes, that's weird.
I'm sorry.
How did it feel when those guys wouldn't fight you?
Useful.
For us, it felt like a minimum requirement. Our father had grandiose ideas.
The judge.
He thought he was living in a storybook. Everything had to be picturesque. On sunny days, we ran around the woods in white cotton dresses. At first, it was mostly about the hair, all sticking out. We looked like nymphs or fairies. We got the faces later. Then he started dreaming about who we would marry. We thought it was all pretty stupid. It was almost the 21st century, and we lived in Wyoming. We ignored it, mostly. But if I'm truly honest, deep down it made an impression. I was aware of it. It came to be part of who I am. Deep down, I guess I believe being pretty is better than being ugly. Deep down, I know I would choose to look like this again. I worry all that deep down stuff makes me shallow. To answer your question, that's how it feels.
Did Rose feel the same way?
Mackenzie nodded. She said, Rose liked things to be perfect. She was smart, and she worked hard, and mostly she made it happen that way. How she looked was the one thing she couldn't control. But happily she turned out okay in that department. I think deep down she took a lot of satisfaction from it. She wanted to be the absolute best, from any angle. She wanted to be the total package. And she was.
Why did she join the army?
I told you.
You told me she would shoot a guy even before he set a foot on her porch, whereas you would wait a moment longer. She could have stayed home and done that.
I feel like I'm on a psychiatrist's couch.
Lay back and pretend you're an actress in a movie. Suppose the hotel had a bar. By now you'd have bought me a cup of coffee. Black, no sugar. Or a beer, if they didn't have coffee. Domestic, in a bottle. You'd have gotten some weird kind of white wine, because of Lake Forest, Illinois.
Right now, we'd be at a table, talking. I would be asking why Rose joined the army, and you would be telling me.
She was looking for something worth it. It turned out the storybook was a lie. He wasn't the wise man of the county. At first, we told ourselves certain practices were almost traditional. He was a lawyer, after all, and lawyers always get paid something, for an opinion, perhaps, prior to the filing. But there were whispers. If they were true, it was something worse. We never found out. Rose and I went to college. They sold the place and moved out of state. We were happy about it. It was a weird place for us. We always knew we were acting in someone else's play. And then the playwright himself turned out to be made up, too. We reacted in slightly different ways. It left Rose needing something real, and me needing a real storybook. And we got both of them, I guess.
Reacher said nothing.
I'm going to bed now, she said. Thanks for talking.
She left him there, alone in the dark, leaning back on the concrete bench, looking at the stars. At that moment, 300 miles away at an I-90 truck stop not far from Rapid City, South Dakota, a guy in a beat-up old pickup truck with Wyoming plates and a vinyl camper shell on the back turned into a service road he had been told led to a covered garage. His name was Stackley, and he was 38 years old, a hard worker, maybe not where he should be in life, but always willing to try his best. He had been told the covered garage was half full with idle snowplows and other winter equipment. He had been told the other half was empty. Plenty of space. He had been told they had it all to themselves. He had been told there would be a guard at the door. There was. He slowed to a stop and wound down his window. He said,
I'm Stackley. You should have gotten a call from Mr. Scorpio. I'm taking over from Billy.
The guard said, You're new Billy?
As of tonight.
Congratulations, Stackley. Drive in and park in slot number 5, forward, on a diagonal. Get out of the truck and open the tailgate.
Stackley did what he was told. He drove in to an echoing, corrugated space the size of an aircraft hangar. On the left were ranks of giant yellow machines mothballed for the summer. On the right was empty space. Someone had chalked diagonal parking bays on the concrete floor. They were numbered 1 through 10. 1 was at the far end, and 10 was closest. 7 and 3 were already occupied. 7 had an old Dodge Durango with its rear door up. 3 had a rusted Silverado with a roll-up cover on the bed. Stackley stopped his own truck short of it and nosed into slot number 5. He got out and lowered his tailgate. Then he checked his watch and waited for midnight. No way to get there faster. The drivers in 3 and 7 were waiting, just like him. They nodded, not exactly friendly, not exactly wary, more like a simple, same boat acknowledgement of life's ups and downs. There were guys not unlike himself. Then an old black four-wheel drive rolled in and parked in the number 6 slot. The driver got out and nodded all around and opened his rear hatch door. Then he stood next to it and waited. He looked just like the others, late 30s, maybe not where he should be in life. 5 minutes later, all 10 slots were full. 10 vehicles, all in a line, 10 tailgates raised or lowered, 10 drivers waiting. The guard watched from the doorway. Stackley checked the time again. It was close to the top of the hour. He saw the guard take a call on his cell. Saw him listen, saw him click off, and heard him call out,
2 minutes, guys. It's nearly here.
2 minutes later, a white panel van drove in a door at the far end of the shed. It looked fresh off the highway. Stackley was reminded of a horse, hot and blowing after a long, fast gallop. It nosed in and stopped almost at once, with its rear door level with the truck and slot number one. The driver got out and walked around and opened up. He pulled crisp white boxes from the back of his van, and the driver from slot number one took them from him and twisted away to slide them in the bed of his pickup. The driver got back in the panel van and rolled it forward 6 or 8 feet and stopped again. He repeated the unloading procedure with the driver from slot number two, stacking a teetering pile of crisp white boxes in the guy's arms, who then rotated away and dumped them in his own truck. Then the van moved on to the guy in slot number three, which gave the guy from slot number one the space to back out and get straight and drive out the same door the van had come in through. A slick operation, Stackley thought, and very well supplied. From where he was standing, he could see what the guy was getting in slot number four. High-dose, time-release oxycodone and transdermal fentanyl patches, the latter in three different strengths. The boxes were made of high-gloss card, antiseptic white, pharmaceutical grade. They had brand names. They were the real thing. Made in America, straight from the factory, solid gold. The panel van moved on, and Stackley stepped up. He got what Scorpio had told him he would get, which was the same volume Billy had been moving, which was a decent quantity for a rural area with not many people. He put his boxes in the camper shell. He put a blanket over them. Not that anyone could see in his windows. They were vinyl, all cracked and yellow, better than a tint from a body shop. He waited until the panel van was serving the guy in slot number seven, and then he backed up and got straight and drove out the door. At that moment, Gloria Nakamura was sitting in her dark and silent car, watching the alley that ran behind Arthur Scorpio's laundromat. She could see his back door. It had a rim of light as if it was standing open an inch. It was a warm night, but not excessive. She had approached on foot, quietly, and looked through the gap, one eye, but she had seen nothing. The angle was too extreme. She walked back to her car. She tried to list the kinds of things that could make a room warm enough to want to open the door for extra ventilation. Tumble dryers, obviously, but not at midnight and not in the back office. Her cell phone rang, her friend in computer crimes, who said, "We've lost Scorpio again. He must have gone to a big box store and bought up a different batch of phones." Nakamura said, "He's in his office, probably making calls. I'm watching him right now. We caught something that might have been him. You can kind of work out the triangulation backward. You can make a guess about what a signal would look like if it was coming from his place. In which case, he made a call to somewhere north of here, but not very far north. He just got a text back from the same number. It says, 'All good tonight, including the new Billy.'"
"When was this?"
"Right now, a minute ago."
"Wait,"
she said. The rim of light around the door grew wider, then died altogether. Arthur Scorpio stepped out into the nighttime gloom. He turned back and locked the door. Then he walked to his car. She said,
"Should I follow him?"
"Waste of gas," her friend said. "He's going home. He goes home every time."
What did it mean, the new Billy?
"I guess something happened to the old Billy."
"Reacher,"
she thought. Billy hadn't found a big enough tree. Reacher was not a superstitious man, not given to flights of fancy or sudden forebodings or existential dread of any kind. But he woke with the dawn, and he stayed in bed. He felt unwilling to move. He propped himself on the pillow and watched his reflection in the mirror on the opposite wall. A distant figure. One of those days. Not just a military thing. Plenty of other professions felt the same way. Sometimes you woke up and you knew for sure from history and experience and weary intuition that the brand new day would bring nothing good at all. Chapter 31. They met in the lobby at 8, the same as the day before. Bramall was in another new shirt, and Mackenzie was in another new blouse. By that point, Reacher's clothes were 2 days old, but once again he had used a whole bar of soap in the shower. They walked up to the same diner and got the same table. They ordered, and Bramall opened the subsequent conversation by asking for a consensus on a certain legal issue, which was that if they accepted Reacher's hypothesis, then by definition they would be looking exclusively at the old ranches off the dirt road west of Porterfield's place, which was a very specific area of investigation. It was precise enough to put in a warrant. Normally, a local law enforcement official would be notified, not required, but expected, a professional courtesy.
"Are you cautioning me again?" Reacher said. "Explicitly and every step of the way?"
"Sometimes things bear repeating."
"Sheriff Connolly will claim Rose's place as a potential crime scene. He'll keep us out. Better not tell him. He still wants to know where Porterfield died. He'll chase any connection."
"Rose's place is a crime scene," Mackenzie said. "No potential about it. Trespass, at least, or illegal occupation of someone else's land. Wyoming has laws about that. Plus a stolen car, it seems. Plus narcotics, we assume. Plus however she's paying for them. I don't want the sheriff to be the one to find her. I can't let him put her in the system. I might never get her out again. We have to get to her first."
"Okay," Bramall said.
They drove south to Mule Crossing and turned at the Bottle Rocket billboard and headed west on the dirt road. The first 3 miles were solitary. Then, not long after they passed Billy's place, they saw a tiny worm of dust on the far horizon, a vehicle on the road, coming toward them, 2 miles away, maybe. It's rare to see another car, like the neighbor told them. "Pull over," Reacher said. "Park on the shoulder. If it's her, we'll want to follow, or her friends. If it isn't, no harm, no foul." Bramall made the same maneuver he had made the day before, which was to stop dead in the traffic lane and then back up carefully like he was in a city garage. He ended up at 90 degrees exactly, which put the westward view through Mackenzie's window. She buzzed it down and buzzed it up to wipe the dust away. The cloud got closer. It was still early in the day. The air was still cool, no thermals yet, no haze, no shimmer. They could see the oncoming vehicle clearly. It was tiny in the distance, dark in color, too far away to say more. Bramall kept the engine running, transmission in gear, foot on the brake, ready to go either left or right. The cloud got closer, the vehicle got clearer. It was old or dull or both. No flash of chrome against the morning sun, no gleam of paint.
"It's not the friends," Bramall said. "It's too small. Their truck was a huge thing."
The cloud got closer. The vehicle was brown. Rust or dust or sun-baked paint, hard to say. It was hugging the road. It looked wider than it was tall.
"It's not her," Mackenzie said. "It's too low. Hers was way more square."
A minute later, it blew on by, juddering and bouncing. No one they had seen before.
just a beat-up old pickup truck with Wyoming plates and a vinyl camper shell on the back. A guy at the wheel, late 30s maybe, looking straight ahead, paying no attention. Nothing.
Onward, Reacher said.
They drove on west, past Porterfield's driveway. Then 11 miles later, past his neighbors, as inconspicuous as ever. They had 6 more places ahead, 3 on the left, 3 on the right. The plan was to look at them all, one by one. Simple in principle, maybe not in practice. The big book of maps had shown neat brown rectangles for houses and barns, but Mackenzie said over the years such places could have built way more than that. Maybe with the proper permissions, maybe not. There could be garages, and smaller barns, and tractor barns, and wood stores, and generator huts, and hobby huts, and staff cottages, and guest cottages, and in-law cottages. Maybe even summer houses deep in the woods. 100 places for Rose to hide, Reacher thought. But she would have chosen somewhere civilized, not a cellar or an attic. Reasonably big, not up a tree. Porterfield had come by from time to time. Hope for the best. The first driveway opening was on the left. They took it. It led to a track like the others they had seen, uneven, full of roots and rocks and gravel. The Toyota clawed onward, but slowly, like an overweight goat. There were more conifer trees than before, and aspen, because the elevation was greater and the terrain more mountainous. The track stayed in the woods all the way, except one bare spot on the shoulder of a hairpin turn, looking east. The Pylady's place was too far away to see, the nearest neighbor. The curvature of the earth was in the way. Then the track swung back into the woods and wound ever onward and upward. 6 miles later, they came out on a scruffy 5-acre compound full of the kind of buildings Mackenzie had mentioned. There was a main house, all log, old, modest in size, nearly matched in its dimensions by a separate log cottage, newer some distance away. In between were log barns and wood stores and storage structures, some of them big enough for a decent truck, some of them as small as garden sheds or doghouses. First thing they did was knock on the door. No one was home. Not a surprise. Reacher figured no one had been home for a couple of years. Maybe more. Every step on the porch raised a puff of dust from the red sand blown as fine as talcum. Second thing they did was check the surrounding terrain. It was crusted smooth by wind and snowmelt, undisturbed. Certainly there were no new tire tracks. The Toyota's own stood out, crisp and fresh and vivid, a total contrast. Mackenzie felt that was game over right there. She felt it was impossible to live in Wyoming without a vehicle. Therefore, no sign of a vehicle meant no sign of life. Rose wasn't there, not camped out in any of the various buildings. Reacher agreed. Grammo agreed. They moved on. They drove the 6 miles back down the track and turned on the dirt road and headed west again. One down, 5 to go. The next driveway would most likely be on the right.
Look,
Grandma said. He pointed. Up ahead, still far away, another worm of dust. At its head, another vehicle coming toward them. It was rare to see another car. Not really. It was getting like Times Square. They drove on, closing the gap. It was a big vehicle coming.
That could be her friends, Mackenzie said. Same size of truck.
Block the road, Reacher said. Make them stop. Bramall took his foot off the gas and steered left and straddled the crown of the road. He put his hazard flashers on and blinked his high beams and coasted on slowly to a 100-yard stretch that had a knee-high rock ledge on one side and a drainage ditch on the other.
He came to a stop halfway between them. No way around. The engine idled. The hazard flashers clicked urgently. He pulsed the headlights.